Hey everybody, Jason here. Just want to let you know this podcast has spoilers for the 1954 Western Veracruz. So if you haven't seen Veracruz, I recommend you check it out. If you're in the States and have Amazon Prime, it's on through the end of February. You can also find it a variety of other places. But we're going to spoil the movie, and then we're going to talk about how to use the movie for inspiration for your role-playing games. So I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Pop yourself a beer or a cold libation. Let me tell you how I wrote this little theme. I went and took a call from Brother Jason, and he tells me that he has a little dream. He says he needs a backwards intro to begin his podcast, and I ask him, what you got? He said, I'll start off with some talking and some moody clips of popcorn fighting, fantasy explorations and some groundless exploitation. Kickstarts that I'm watching and some blind unboxings, full month horror movie marathon. Sometimes I let the dogs come on, contest and of course you know it's all about games. I said, slow down, let's just start with the name. It's the Nerds RPG Variety Cast with the other Jason.
Welcome back to Nerds RPG Variety Cast. I'm your host, Jason. Today's a special show. I've got a couple guests with me. We're going to talk about 1954's Veracruz, a wonderful Western, and we're going to talk about how you can use it in your games. This is a movie that's got a mixed reviews, both when it came out and today. Some people love it, some people don't. I think we're going to try to convince you to love it. So we'll see how that goes. But joining me today, I have my good buddy Carl from The Gemologist Presents. How are you doing today, Carl?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me on this. And we also have KR King from D&D Homebrew. How are you doing, KR?
I'm doing good, and likewise, thanks for having me.
Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. I mean, I know you're a huge fan of the director, Robert Aldrich. How about you give the audience the elevator pitch and fill them in on Robert Aldrich. Let them know a little bit about this wonderful director.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Aldrich became known for his tough guy films and sort of this brutal, a lot of blue-collary type people, but he's actually from a very prominent family of Rhode Island, the Aldrich family. I think some of the Aldriches married into the Rockefellers and some other people. And so he went to Hollywood and he got a job through an uncle at RKO and started off kind of as a gopher assistant. And then for many years, he worked as an assistant director. And it's very rare for an assistant director in Hollywood to make it to that next level, because you're the person that goes to the actors and makes sure they're ready to go. And you're kind of a sub producer's, thing. You're keeping things organized. Now, he claimed this taught him all about the movie business. This told him how to set up shots. He watched these directors. He watched at RKO how they did it economically, because that was basement. They had some Poverty Row type studio. And he learned, because he later became a producer and he produced all his films, and he learned how to do things in an organized way. He also watched directors get along with stars, because he's right there as kind of the middleman person. And he learned to often yell at the assistant director, not at the star, because they get mad, and all these techniques. Right. So then he gets his breaks here. I think it was did a little television in the late 40s. He worked for a long time as assistant director. He got kind of older in his 40s. And then he does, I think it's Body and Soul, which he was the assistant director, met John Garfield and whatnot. And he wanted to make a film. I think his first direction film here, I got to make sure I get this exactly right, was, so by this time in the 50s, he's doing television. And his first film that he does was with, I think, Big Leaguer or something. But then he did Apache with Burt Lancaster. And that set him up, although Veracruz really set him up. But he met Harold Heck, the famous writer of the 30s, playwright and everything, and then Burt Lancaster. And Burt Lancaster loved the idea that Robert Aldrich was incredibly intelligent, because he had been an acrobat, circus performer, sort of uneducated. He was very impressed by Aldrich's intellect, but that Aldrich was a tough guy. He didn't put up with anybody. And he really liked that. A lot like Walter Hill, the guy we talked about in another movie. He was able to withstand that. And that's how he eventually made Veracruz, the movie we're going to say, because Lancaster also was intrigued by his thoughts about, you got to be a producer, you got to be in control. That's where you make the money. A lot of those guys in the 50s did that, were trying to make production companies Jimmy Stewart did it, and all these guys. And that was the idea behind this. And Aldrich goes on to make, just a year later, he made Kiss Me Deadly, which I can't recommend enough for people to see. It's a Mickey Spillane. He took Mickey Spillane, if you ever read his books, they're meathead type. They're not, they're kind of interesting just because it's, you know, bam, 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 action. There's a famous book where Mickey Spillane, he goes on a vacation. He's tired of all the violence. And at the lake, he gets beat up by mobsters and starts fighting. You know, so, but he took that movie and made it into something genius. And later on, he did, people know The Longest Yard. People know The Dirty Dozen. He did Flight of the Phoenix, which is a great adventure film. Jimmy Stewart is in that one where they crash this plane. They did a remake, which was pretty hokey. He did some Grand Guignol movies with Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. And of course, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. I would recommend that to people as just watch it and revel in it. It's both a parody and a great film. He could do anything, right? But he was a very strong personality. And I've just heard from people, I haven't seen it, that he was poorly represented in this one of those feud TV shows. He took it to both Joan Crawford and Betty Davis. He didn't put up with any of their antics on that film. They're feuding and stuff, and they resented that. So, but I think a great guy and perfect for this film and perfect for being able to control Burt Lancaster, because one of the things, now that we can go into this, there was going to be trouble here with Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster, right? Because he was a notorious scene stealer, you know, and he's the young guy. He's like 15 years younger than Gary Cooper. Gary Cooper's an aging star. He was aging kind of rapidly. You know, he got sick later in the late 50s. But of course, Gary Cooper was no slouch either. And Aldrich had to deal with these two. And so imagine that they're going together. They're making this Western. I think we can talk about, you guys talk about this, the idea behind Veracruz, which was totally, some people hated it for the violence, the amorality. But this is what then leads to everything, the Sam Peckinpah and Sergio Leone and the cynical Western and all this stuff. It's like a Western noir in a way, although it's not lit that way or anything. It's got some real classic Hollywood Western of the 50s, you know, the outfits and the, you know, the lighting and everything is very bright. But man, when you look at this, you realize this is a precursor, 1954, of what we see in the 60s.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, go ahead, Jason. You're probably going to say the same thing I am. But yeah, it's probably labeled now, in retrospect, as the first spaghetti Western.
It is. Yeah. And what I was going to read, I'll throw it right back to you, Carl. What I was just going to read, we talk about it being a little controversial. I was going to read a quick blurb from the New York Times review of this from 1954 when it came out. This was a Christmas movie. Okay. This came out at Christmas time. And so Bosley
Crowther, I think.
Crowther. Thank you.
Yeah, famous kind of stuffy critic of the New York Times too.
Yeah, right. He said Veracruz, to put it bluntly, is a pretty atrocious film loaded with meaningless violence and standard horse opera cliches. You don't get much harsher than that, right? And yeah, and at the end of this, he even criticizes the look of it, which we're going to talk about the cinematography. Mm-hmm. But he says the scenery might look pretty if the fuzziness of superscope and the blobbiness of the color were not offensive to the eye. In short, again, to put it bluntly, there is nothing to redeem this film. Not even the spirit of the season. Some Christmas show, indeed. He really did not like this movie.
Well, it's interesting. I'll real quick. He criticized Bonnie and Clyde vehemently in the late 60s. And that kind of ended his career as a critic because people were just like, Bosley has no idea. Yeah. He had no idea what he's talking about.
Yeah. But what's interesting to me is we watch all these movies. And some of us have had a chance. We've been lucky enough to go to the theater and see them. But none of us have really seen them the way they were. Unless we saw them back in the day, saw them the way they were back in the day. Because like you think of like How the West Was Won, they had special theaters built to show How the West Was Won. So even if you go to like a cinema that's doing a special showing of How the West Was Won, you're not going to see it in the, you know, they had screens that went like, you know, three quarters of the way around the theater and stuff. So we're never seeing it. So how the Superscope looked in 54, I don't know. But I know that today, watching it on TV, Veracruz looks darn good to me.
It looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love the fact that it is filmed on location, though I'm sure we'll get to talking about that in a little bit. Because
filmed entirely in Mexico.
Yeah, filmed entirely in Mexico in the Veracruz area. They even have a great scene, even though it's probably not on the way if you try to figure historically where everything is at. They even have a scene where they go through Teotihuacan, which is impressive, right? It's really neat to see that, to see, to, I can't imagine those guys at that time running up the pyramid and filming down.
Because you see not only the guy with the rifle,
it's like an over
the Warista. Like,
do they have drones back then? No, the guy's got to be up on the, it's crazy.
Well, that's the other amazing scene we see in there, which was very unusual for the time, is when they're in the courtyard, when they first meet the Warista general, and we first meet Cesar Romero is the, you know, the representative of the Maximilian, Emperor Maximilian. And they had the scene where the rebels are standing up on the heights, and they pan around, and, you know, they spin the camera, not quite 360, but it's, you know, it's like 290 or something. But, you know, that's a very unusual shot for that time period with a handheld camera, like, or we say handheld, but it's not handheld like we think of it. They were huge cameras that, and to turn it like that was pretty unusual, especially on location like that.
Right. And Leone famously does a 360 in Good, the Bad, and the Ugly at one point. Right. And I always think, because he watched this movie a lot. I mean, he was.
I'm sure. He loved it. Seven does that too, you know, where they paint they, even the same, almost like the peasants pop up type of thing. Right.
Right. Right.
So I'm glad you recommend this movie, because this is the first time I'd seen it, actually. So, I, you know, it's sight unseen. I haven't seen it multiple times. So, and we are. My wife Amy and I are doing like this Western best 10 best Westerns according to IMBD, which will get controversial based on some discussions I've seen recently later, a little later on. But you know, so this was like, so Jason's like, oh, you should check out this movie. So we checked out this movie, and I was pleasantly surprised, actually. So I did enjoy the movie.
It's not a perfect movie. You know, there are some issues in here. You could argue that the female roles aren't fleshed out enough. They're almost there kind of just to accent the man, Ray. And so there are some failings in the movie, sure. But I think it does a really good job of doing, if you want to talk about gray morality, we have that. And you could argue Gary Cooper's character, I mean, at the time you had the South and the, you know, the Lost Cause and all that kind of stuff. And if this was made today, he would have been a Union. He would have been with the Union, not with the Confederacy, right? And you know, his character shift may or may not have made a whole lot of sense. I think they could have maybe spent a little more time with him to explain his motivations. But Cooper does hold his, he was warned not to do this movie, that Lancaster was going to outshadow him. But I think he actually does a good job here. I think they both hold their own, even in scenes together. I mean, Burt Lancaster with that smile, he talks about Cesar Romero has a crocodile smile, but Lancaster is the one where you always see that, you know, that Cheshire Cat smile.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
And
he had that love of being evil, right? Love of, look at me. Look what I'm going to do now, you know, taking these kids away to be killed, or, you know, just one thing after the killing his buddy that comes at the end to rescue him. And he goes, hey, great. And shoots him. And you're like that, like a force of nature. You know, I think the interesting thing you're talking about Cooper's character, notice how he separates them at the very beginning. One came alone. So he's not with these bad guys that are coming, these mercenaries, but also that, the Southern, they put him in New Orleans, which is Louisiana, was a little bit different of the South. It's not the old South per se. Mm-hmm. And they made some changes to try to, we're not in the gone with the wind view of the Civil War anymore. We're coming up to the anniversary. But, you know, and things, I think if you look at Ken Burns's documentary, they wouldn't, you know, Shelby Foote makes you want to join the Confederacy or whatever. You know, I mean, you're just like, that was a different point of view that we would not have today.
Yeah. And even like a main character recently in a Western, in Helen Wheels, Cullen Bohannon, played by Anson Mount, is ex-Confederate, you know, officer. So I don't know. I don't think they would have changed that. I mean, you know, there's plenty of still documentaries and films on the James gang. I mean,
I don't have an issue with him being a former Confederate. You know, one size always good, one size always bad. I'm not saying that at all.
No,
I think his motivations. Well, part of this we know, Gary Cooper made them rewrite that part. That part was written to be a lot more grayer than it is, and Gary Cooper kept trying to get it rewritten to be more noble and feeling, traditional kind of white hat cowboy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So
that's interesting. Go ahead.
No, Carl.
Well, I was going to say is the interesting thing to me is that I think it's a great way to show what's happening, right after the war. There's a lot of these people who've been fighting for 4 years, and probably even earlier, because a lot of these were veterans of the Mexican-American War too. And then they're like, well, we got nothing else to do. You know, my home's been destroyed. How am I going to make a living? So they either go west and cause a lot of trouble, right? Or they go become mercenaries abroad. And, you know, it's huge. You can see a huge influx in mercenaries, you know, abroad at this time, fighting all over the world. And then here, you know, Mexico's easy. You just cross the border here. But, you know, I think that's pretty interesting. Like, where do all these ex-soldiers go, right? They go here to help, quote unquote, solve other conflicts or participate really in other conflicts, right? Maybe not solve
it. Well, especially the characters in this movie, they go down there for the money. That's right. Why they're there.
Total mercenaries.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting you say about after the war, we think of the 50s as this gray flannel decade, everyone was conforming. But in fact, there were tons of veterans that came out who became all those guys that formed those motorcycle gangs. They were all veterans. A lot of them were in the bomber pilots and people that had been in really tense situations. And they tried to go back to working at the candy store, and they wanted that excitement. They just couldn't conform. And so they started riding bikes on the weekends. Then they started riding bikes all the time, you know, and there's a whole history of that. And because a lot of them had PTSD and people didn't talk about it. Then I had my grandfather's brother had been over in Europe and everything, and he just came home. I liked the guy, Uncle Don. He was very friendly, but he lived with his mom the rest of his life. He had PTSD, and he never quite got it together after World War II. And, you know, that was a real thing. So I think what Carl is saying is exactly right. There's this mood of course, it's worth it. We think, well, you beat Hitler and you did everything, but I went through this psychological trauma, and I'm supposed to just come back and act like nothing's wrong with me. And there was with a lot of these guys, and that excitement that you're talking about, I can go back with my buddies and do that again. And I think this is all part of this filtered through the Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, maybe Aldridge being a tough guy could see that, you know, maybe in society. I mean, he seems to make a lot of movies like addressing this in a way, right? Addressing this grayness, this violence, this amorality, and how is it viewed in society? Right. And so I think, that's probably one of the, you know, a good synergy of director and, you know, scene eating, hamming it up type of Burt Lancaster with the very suave, you know, polished Gary Cooper. I think it works really well.
Cooper didn't ever needed to yell at anybody, you know.
Oh,
yeah.
His authority is right there.
And what's great with Gary Cooper in this, you know, whether it is how I don't mean to belittle his performance at all, because I really like him in this, and you can see him trying to decide what side's he on, because he legitimately likes Burt Lancaster's character, right? You know, he knows he's a bad guy. I mean, Lancaster tells him from the very beginning of the movie, you know, he's a bad guy the entire movie, but you like him. And Gary Cooper likes him, and he wants to like him. And that's why when we get to the Maximilian's palace and they're at the ball and Captain comes up and he's giving Lancaster a hard time, Gary Cooper comes to his defense. You know, there's no reason he didn't have to do that, but he did. You know, he tells the story about the tin soldier and all that kind of stuff. And so he backs him up. And even after seeing, you know, like those kids, whoever mentioned the kids, you know, where they threatened them to get out from the Juaristas. And when Cesar Romero asked Gary Cooper, you know, it was just a bluff, wasn't it? Cooper knew it wasn't a bluff.
Because earlier, these other guys come up and Lancaster just draws on him and pop, pop, pop. Right. Yeah.
Such a great scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause that's the classic, hey, we're not going by you anymore. And he goes, who's with Charlie? I'm with Charlie. And he does this, you know, super draw where he kills two guys. Yeah. How he does that, I'm not quite. It's this movie world.
Yeah.
But if you watch that scene, the bodies are laying there in this dirt, the entire scene, just sprawled out. That is not a 50s Hollywood. You know, it was so effective because you're just like, wow, we're in a world that I haven't seen very much in big time, you know, Hollywood Westerns.
Yeah, even the skirmish scenes like later, too. There's like, you know, it's like,
well,
lots of dead people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the scene at the end of the movie, I mean, I love the ambush scene, too. But the scene at the end of the movie is just it's right out of a World War II movie. It's you could see that. I mean, think about Saving Private Ryan. You've got them taking effectively bandolier torpedoes to blow the front gates of the garrison there, right? Yeah. I mean, that's right out of a World War II movie, this battle down there. And it looks great. I mean, the battles are, you know, and like I say, the ambush battle is also great.
I guess this brings to me a point, and maybe something, I don't know, maybe KR, maybe you're right that a lot of vets want to go see this movie because it did do pretty well at the box office.
Yeah.
Right. It did do, like, you know, it made 10 times the amount it cost, which I think is, you know, pretty, what, 1.6 million to make, and then 11.5 million at the box office. So,
right. And Aldrich had his movies made, generally speaking, up until the end, made money, you know, and he knew what the public wanted, and he was good at that. I was going to say The Dirty Dozen. Talk about a cynical view of the military.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they make the generals look, you know, just bad, you know. And again, we think, oh, that's the 60s, you know, it was influencing. Well, it started off back then.
Oh, right.
And Lee Marvin was a guy, very liberal, even though he was Mr. Tough Guy. But he was also very like, yeah, he hated the producers and the powers that be. And he saw that as America generally, too, this hypocrisy. So Aldrich and those guys were all tied into this, even though we think of them as perhaps not having that attitude. They didn't wear it on their sleeves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. So I like this too because of the historical context. You know, it's during the Franco-Mexican War. So like effectively, like the French through the imperial the powers in Europe, Napoleon III is in power in France, and now they sent troops to bolster his cousin, Maximilian, who's a Habsburg, right? So the Austrian Habsburg. So it's crazy, right? So like it's effectively this foreign power is ruling over Mexico.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a kind of an interesting, you know, like a story of rebellion during this time period in Mexico. And I think that's kind of, I mean, maybe that also appeals to our American sense of the underdog.
That's what our worst general wanted. He wanted to appeal to him. He goes, you as Americans can appreciate our desire for freedom or independence, you know? And they're like, no, show me the money.
Well, and the revolutionaries are shown, you know, he does retreat when they threaten the kids, and we see
they're the good guys in the movie. Come on.
Yeah, they're the good guys, but it's very in the background in a way, right? They're not, it's not really their story. It's the story, of course, it's Cooper versus Lancaster all the way.
Right.
And I don't know how much the plot we want to do, but when it's Gary Cooper figures out that the wagon that they're hauling this Marquise.
Yeah, that's the main story, right? That's the main story.
Right.
Go ahead, Kara.
That they're hauling this. They've gone down to escort this Marquise. And I don't think, was there treasure in there? But they were going to get paid to escort her to the coast and take her away. But Cooper realizes this. Look at the wagon. This
That was a cool scene. That was kind of cool, like little, you know, hint there. I love that.
Yeah, he figures it out. And he tells Lancaster. He doesn't keep it to himself.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, they then break into the thing at night, and it's got millions in gold. It's got an unbelievable amount for 1867 or whatever it is. And they agreed, we're going to take this gold. And the Marquisa, she's also totally amoral.
Right? Yeah.
The only... So she has no... She's going to kill them. I mean, at the... I don't want
to... She's going to steal the gold, right? She's going to...
Yeah.
The gold's not even supposed to go to pay French troops. Right, to bolster Maximilian and his men.
Right.
And she's just going to steal it and then kill these dudes who steal it for her, like with the help of the pirates or whatever.
Great scene where the captain comes and he goes, oh, so apparently we're going to have three people on the ship. And she says, oh, no, only one.
Yeah, and he's like, that's great.
Really? Yeah. And he's like, okay, man. So, and again, it just, where's our femme? Where's the woman, the good woman? Even film noir, they always have they have the femme fatale, but they usually have a good woman who's like,
well, you do.
The guy should go to her.
You have Sarah the worries, you know, the worries. Now, she was a Spanish, Spanish actress, pretty famous Spanish actress.
Yes.
Who did a little bit in Hollywood, but really her fame is mostly in Europe.
Yeah. Sarah Montiel. Yeah.
Yeah.
And known, I think, as the most beautiful woman in Spain. She was kind of the, you know, leading film star. The other woman, I don't have it, what her name was. She was a huge star in France. She had been, she was known as somebody that was, again, most beautiful girl or whatever. In this, I wonder if there was any, because they don't make the Spanish woman look as good as she actually does. You know, they sort of She certainly looks good, obviously, but she isn't as glamorous. I wonder if there's something in there. I don't know. I don't know how these things
work. They wanted to make her look like, you know, like, yeah, like part of the, like the
peasant,
people.
Right? Part
like
of the peasant world, yeah. Right.
Well, she's a papyrus lady, right? But yeah. So what's interesting is...
Oh, the other scene that I thought also shows ahead. The amorality mm-hmm. that we're kind of speaking to is when they capture one of the rebels, yeah. And then they, like, toy with them, right? They chase them through the hills.
Lancers
do. Yeah, the Lancers do. So, you know, so no one is good, you know?
Yeah.
No one is
right.
Really.
So to, but I want to, or I'm sorry, go ahead, Kara, I'll let you.
Oh, no, I was just saying they're going to make the French, and the Dragoons are all dressed up in these very European empire, European, because of course you've got the Monroe Doctrine, we don't have anymore, but at that time, they famously said, we don't want interference by these, you know, they're declaring their independence and we don't want any more powers to do this. And then the French did it. They saw the Civil War as an opportunity to right. do this. We were busy. And so they did this. They landed these guys there. And of course, it did not end well for Maximilian. He was executed.
The year after this film.
Yeah. And his wife famously went back to Europe and kind of went insane. She just was bitter about this whole thing and lived in her castle for like 50 years or something. I can't remember. But anyway, just he was this, to her, this tragic figure. But to us, it's like, dude, you're taking a big chance going over to Mexico and so just announcing you're the emperor. They've been free for a little bit there. They're not going to buy into this.
Right. To rein it back just a little bit and just one, if anybody else has anything to finish up on the movie part before we transition to the RPG part. But one thing I want to mention that I think is really interesting is you talk about how maybe they dressed down, Montel a little bit, Sarah Montel mm-hmm. a little bit, but you know, in this movie, I think they show the Mexicans in a pretty good light. They really do. Which
yeah, I thought
mean,
so. That's why
be.
I was curious yeah, when I read be. That the Mexican government didn't at the time didn't like it.
Right, exactly. The Mexican government didn't like that they were showing them as dirty peasants. So in the future they wouldn't let that happen. Which is why when you go to the Magnificent Seven, we see them all in pure, clean, white, and all this stuff. But the problem is in the Magnificent Seven. The Mexicans are shown much worse than they are in this movie because here
they're pathetic.
Yeah, exactly. Here they have agency. They have pride. You know, they're. Yeah. I like what they do here. Where in the Magnificent Seven, they need people to save them, and they're pitiful. And they're so the Mexican government actually made their subjects look worse when they enforced that to the movie industry.
Well, I think also like I read somewhere too that I guess in Mexico, Maximilian is seen as a tragic and liberal minded figure. So also the kind of effete, kind of poor portrayal of Maximilian and the imperial regime in Mexico has been, you know, I guess revised or revisited in Mexican history. So that's possible that at that time that was part of that sentiment. I was surprised too, because I was like, yeah, that's pretty, you know, I'm glad they filmed it in Mexico. That's pretty good. It seems like they got a lot of, you know, extras from the territory, you know, kind of neat. And I think, it's very interesting. I don't know when but like a lot of these early movies, say Treasures of the Sierra Madre, for example, mm-hmm. too, used a lot of actors from the area where they filmed in too. And, you know, and I don't know where that changed in Hollywood, because it seems it changed late 60s, early 70s, but, you know, but that, I thought that's pretty neat. And maybe also that was because that was part of, you know, the mindset of the production company and Aldrich to kind of do that on location. We're going to get the locals. And that somehow I thought that was great. And that's one of the appeals to me of this movie.
Yeah. I would say two other things that interest me is the cast of supporting cast. Cause you've got Charles Bronson, who was Charles Baczynski at that time. You got Ernest Borgnine. You've got a gambler guy. That's a slick guy. He doesn't really play much of a part. You have an African-American Union soldier there who asks, would you object? And of course, Gary Cooper says, I have no objection. You know, they have no problem with each other. The war is over. Which was a sentiment that was important in a way
at that
time. Lincoln said, you know, charity for all, malice towards none. But all those heavyweights there as supporting
Cesar
characters
Romero.
Great. Yeah, he's awesome. And, you know, they could just pull these guys out of the woodwork as supporting actor types. The other thing was they have this thing at the ball where they do the shooting of the candles, right? They got to show their prowess. So this is a classic Hollywood mano a mano, and the emperor, that's hilarious. The emperor's first, Burt Lancaster shooting out candles. And then, of course, Gary Cooper one-ups him And then the Emperor's like, let me take my shot in my feet, you know, European accent voice. And he's able to do it, actually. It's pretty impressive. And then, but the guys underneath, the guys holding the candles, super nervous. And Sergio Leone did that, you know, in A Few Dollars More. They have shootouts between Lee Van Cleef and, you know, Clint Eastwood. And up till a parody of it, if you see some of those Trinity movies where he does all this kind of crazy shooting, it almost became a joke at that point. Mm-hmm. But he definitely was influenced by those. And to me, that's where it's a little Hollywood stagey, right? The whole ball is a little, you know, I was almost expecting maybe they did have, they had some dancing scenes and stuff.
Yeah, maybe a music. They're going to break out a song.
Exactly. That's where it was still of its time in that one.
Yeah.
The only shooting that really bugged me, but I think was out of place, was in the very beginning when Gary Cooper shoots the revolver at, you know, very as soon as he buys the horse and he's being chased, he finds that, you know, why are they chasing me? Because you're riding their horse, right? But but he turns around, he just shoots the gun out of the guy's hand when they're both full gallop as they're chasing him. I think that was that's old Hollywood, right? That's Roy Rogers. And that's
exactly
that was maybe a little much.
Jack Elam's also in this movie. It's another
a young Jack Elam. Yeah, right? He was young once.
Well, it's interesting because Carl, you mentioned George McCready. Of course, he plays Maximilian, and he's about 30 or 40 years older than the actual Emperor was. The Emperor was only like 20 something.
At the time,
Maximilian was. But let's kind of transition into RPGs if we could. I guess last thing. Do you guys recommend this movie?
I recommend this
question.
It's good. If you're like into Western genre, this spaghetti Western, pre-spaghetti Western era, I mean, yeah, I would definitely recommend it. Cause you can see the framing, the staging, like KR suggested, Sergio Leone definitely watched these and took, you know, but he is noted for saying that he did take a lot of guidance from, you know, the way the shootouts are staged in like High Noon, for example, or in Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, right? So that, you know, that sort of different angles or that close up looking at the face and, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, but this movie definitely has that aspect. And I guess we didn't have the last shootout was between Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster either. So,
right. You know, which again, like we see the good hat, the white hat on Gary Cooper, right?
Oh, I know. Totally.
Black hat. He should have shot him down with the rifle. You know,
And that kind of, that's a Hollywood thing that we see. And it's, you know, Once Upon a Time in the West, the shootout with Bronson and, you know, Henry Ford would have shot him from a distance. He didn't need to know, what is it you're doing here? I've got to know, you know, but then it's not a movie, right? So, but you do see the origins of this, and you don't have the super duper close ups and because that Aldrich and those guys would have considered that, I think, hokey, the giant face in the screen.
Yeah.
But it's operatic, right? That's what he's going from that perspective. It's a little bit different. But I would recommend this to people, and just know it's in the 50s, and you know, it has some things that are not as modern, I guess, to our sensibilities or whatever.
But a plus of this, you know, it's 94 minutes, but it's a tight movie and it moves. You're not going to, this isn't one of those, it's not like a 70s movie where you'll fall asleep in the middle of it. And I'm joking. I love 70s movies, but this movie goes at a fast pace and it's well plotted and it's easy to follow. And I don't know. I just think it's a very well put together movie that a modern audience could watch and appreciate.
Yeah. I'm going to do my mantra that I always do on these with Jason, where I say that nice thing about these movies, it's about adults doing adult things, and everybody in there, you believe this is what they do, right? These are not cast from the latest teen show, and now they're in a Western and they're all playing like, and they're, you know, they're real people. And I love that about, I love it about movies today, but especially these movies in those days. I just think, maybe as I've gotten older or something, I don't know. I just really appreciate that these characters are, you can believe them in these roles.
Yeah. All right. So what kind of game, Jason, are we playing with this?
Well, so the interesting thing is if I was going to adapt this, now, if you're going to adapt as a Western, of course, my go-to is Boot Hill, or if you have a group that's willing to learn it, Aces and Eights. But the cool thing about Westerns, and we see this as we're talking about Walter Hill this year, is every movie Walter Hill made was a Western. It might be a different, but he viewed them all as Westerns, right? Or views, he's still alive. But so the cool thing about Westerns are you can take this plot and you can slap this right into D&D. You can put this into Traveler. You can put this into any game system. So I don't know that the system is super important, but there are a lot of but we can talk about systems. Mm-hmm. But the cool thing is there are a lot of great things you can borrow from this movie, either plot points, you could lift the plot, you know, whole cloth, or you can just borrow little bits of it that are very cool that you can plug into your RPG. So I thought maybe we could talk about some cool things we could borrow from this movie. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about PvP, since this movie has the whole PvP element that actually has with three players, really. Well, four players, because Cesar Romero's really doing his own angle as well. And he knows
he's got his angle.
Yeah. So it's really that, you know, everybody's trying to do their best poker face and wait as long as they can. The movie's a real push your luck thing, because how long can you wait to backstab the other people before they backstab you? You know, because you want their help as long as you can have it. But if you wait too long, then you're going to get backstabbed.
And so even Sarah really Montiel's character has an angle, right? So,
oh yeah,
right? So,
yeah.
So you know, there's a lot of potential principles, like main characters, I guess, in this. But I think the first thing you could do in many genres, you know, from a fantasy genre to a sci-fi genre, the displaced veteran, right? So displaced veterans, we just faced a civil war in any genre that you mm-hmm. can think of, and now you know where do we go? We're not being paid, so we got to go and find the next conflict. You know, our desire, but our goal, our immediate goal is to make some money, right? So I think it's a good hook, right?
Yeah. Well, we even see this in like Firefly, right?
Firefly. Yeah.
When we first meet Firefly, you know, we've got our captain. He's like, no, we're just for money. You know, this is all, you know, I've given up on causes. You know, the brown coats were great, but we lost. So, but by the end of that, you know, they're getting into causes and they're doing, you know, they, even though they say they're just for money, they have, you know, like Han Solo.
You can see
Han Solo and Burt Lancaster a little bit here, right? I mean, obviously Han Solo is a much nicer, better character in the end than Burt mm-hmm. Lancaster's character is, but you can kind of see where maybe that might've inspired Lucas.
Well, Lucas was definitely inspired by these, yeah. You know, by Kurosawa in the Japanese vein and Sergio Leone and, you know, the Western, which who of course mm-hmm. was also influenced by Kurosawa. But, you know, I mean, there's a lot of, it's not derivative, but there's a lot of like, I guess, inspiration taken, you know, as we see in these different framings. But I think definitely the displaced veteran, that would be to me a really good hook that's sellable, you know, in either, I guess the big genres we're talking about, sci-fi, fantasy, or like Western historical.
I think too, the idea of, let's say you're just going to run this instead of PvP, just the group gets involved with a group of NPCs that you've created to take something from this leader and deliver something somewhere else. And it doesn't have to be, they could be, you know, third, fourth, whatever system you're using, not high level, right? But because they need this help. Maybe the other side has a healer if you're using that kind of system. But it becomes clear that these guys are very shady. They may be out to kill you at the end, but you need them to get through this pass or, you know, the barren hills where the orcs are, something like that, where you're on a desperate, it's almost like Wages of Fear kind of thing, that movie right. Where they're taking the dynamite over the thing. And the group has to decide. And then again, if you're in a system, sometimes it's hard in 5e to run a group of NPCs as a GM because you're doing so much stuff there. But if you keep it kind of simple, two or three, and there's two or three in the group or something, and they all need each other, when do they make that switch? When do the players realize, these guys, they might just try to kill us when we get to the end or something? Mm-hmm. It might be interesting just because that's what this is about. We know Gary Cooper doesn't trust anybody, and you could have this as a group, depending on how many people you have in your campaign. And the other thing I would say is the leader of a place that you realize, even though you're working for him, he's corrupt, he's bad, he's, you know, exploiting the people. And do the players decide, depending on the players, because my players right now are like, man, whatever. They're not that worried about being good. They're kind of like Bert's gang. But you might have players that go, this is no good. Maybe I'll deliver this, but I'm going to give it to the rebel side, right? Because then there's the rebel aspect.
I do like the false noble cause too, like escorting this person, a person of an important asset, you know, to the place. But then it's really about like the treasure. And I love that sort of second secret mission would be great to like figure out, like for the players to figure that out. Even if you do like the same thing, the river crossing, and you're like, oh, just make a perception check and you huh, that's kind of weird that the, you know, the horses are struggling more than they should through this ford, you know, type of thing.
Because if so the if there was a magic item, a really powerful magic and it's got a lead-lined chamber to prevent any detect magics or whatever, and the players notice this is really heavy, this wagon. What could this be? That kind of a thing. And it's heavily guarded. They're going to have to. They don't just park it at night necessarily, you know, where you could just walk up and look. I mean, it's kind of like, why are they leaving the 5 million sitting here? But anyway.
Well, because they don't think anyone knows about it. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
You'd put a few people there just in case, I think. But anyway, that's so, yeah, that would be great because you could have anything in a fantasy setting or in a Boot Hill type Aces and Eights. I'm going to be playing Aces and Eights, I hope, at GaryCon because I really would love to play that game again.
I like Aces and Eights. It's a really cool game. I love the mechanic.
We played Aces and Eights, just real quick diversion. My only thought about Aces and Eights is I love the system, but I think you need a dedicated group to play it and a group that's willing to learn the mechanics. And you can't play it like once a quarter. You've got to play it enough that people are familiar because the shot clock, not the shot clock as much as the count up mechanic. And people have to get comfortable with that count up mechanic for your actions. Mm-hmm. And once you have that and everybody buys in, I think it's great. The problem is if you're teaching people the mechanics every game, it'd be tough, but
it's down.
Yeah. But it's a neat game. It really is. Kenzerco they really knocked it. Like I say, my go-to Westerns are Boot Hill or Aces and Eights. Honestly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think what's interesting, like I was just thinking like, cause of the technology and stuff too, like, I don't know if you're familiar with Iron Kingdoms, KR or Jason, but Iron Kingdoms would be great for that. Cause you could even have like the stagecoach or train or whatever, you know, obviously Eberron, right? It's another cool one that you could do with that. I mean, if you wanted to make it a bit sort of still Western genre themed and a little more heroic and with some weirdness thrown in, you could do Deadlands, right? Deadlands would be a great,
sure, a great one. Oh, 100%.
So.
Yeah, because would work with, it doesn't, you can add magic and fantasy, like Kara said, you can lead line, whatever. But so, yeah, this would work great with Deadlands, actually.
Yeah, and I think a Sway system in general, because the Sway system has that movie-ness to it where you can, you know, ace on rolls and do things that are, you know, heroic seeming, right? And then you have like extras and wild cards that, you know, so you can kind of mirror a lot of the extras, including the gang, you know, Burt Lancaster's character's gang, you know, as opposed to aces and characters, right? So
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to bring up is the idea of the gang. So we see the gang there and they're all loosely confederated, but there's no real deep loyalty in anybody, right? Well, maybe a little bit with Ballard, the Union soldier, and to Gary Cooper at the end, which is kind of weird, or not weird, but you know, it's kind of odd connection there. But really, the gang, and we even see at the end, the gang turns on Burt Lancaster and them, like, what have you been hiding from us? And, you know, they hold them all gunpoint and all that. And so the idea of having your hirelings and or henchmen, but you have these forces that maybe aren't as powerful as the player characters, but almost as powerful as the player characters. And again, we get to that same situation KR mentioned where you really need them, but where they kind of turn on the players at some point and are like, listen, you know, we're going to take that with us, whether you come out and all your horses are gone or whatever. But now you, as a GM, you can't have your hirelings turn on the players every time because then they'll never trust you as a GM. But right. You could do it once, or you could do it that one time. I think you could make it really effective.
But if it's the player's fault that they turn, like if the players do something that's, you know, like you said, like, why didn't you tell us what was going on, you know, type of thing. If the player betrays the NPCs, then, well, that's the player's fault, right? Yeah.
And if you set it up that they're not trustworthy, you know, you need these hirelings. There's nobody else. And they've got expertise or they've got something that you need. Then you're just always ready. It's not like a surprise, right? Because it's no surprise if you're watching this movie, you're like, what? Ernest Borgnine is not a good guy? No, he's not.
Well, and you know,
Carl's gonna rape some woman? He's gonna do that.
Right. Yeah. And they're all watching, cheering him on. So you know, Carl, you actually did this in Twilight 2000 because they had the other Americans, they had the American officers that were gonna try to take control of the group.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, because they're like, well, we're officers, we gotta take control of the group when really the non-com or like a non-com veteran, ex Green Beret or SEAL had kind of taken over the group because the officers had been all like sick and injured and stuff. So you could do it. But I think the cool thing in that situation is that the players didn't just off and kill him. They just captured them and turned him over to the nearby authorities. But yeah, I think it could be a really fun instance of sort of this PvP idea. Or I think, oh, here's what I was thinking of as I was babbling. So I think a good way to do that, though, is something I've seen in some free league games like Alien, RPG, Walking Dead, is that characters have their own like secrets or agendas, their drives or their issues, right? And that issue, and you just give like a player a little tag, and I feel like you could do this in D&D or any game that normally doesn't have this. It's like you just give someone, the GM gives them, well, you know, a secret. You have this drive. This is a bit of your backstory, or hey, tell me something that you want to do, or what's your character's motivation ahead of time, and then you can sort of play on that, and then you just give them a little issue or secret, and then the players eat that up. They love that. The secret android is going to betray the whole party. I mean, come on.
Right. Well, you wouldn't automatically kill the android? The reason you don't know the androids in Alien is because A, you don't know, or B, you know you need them because that android's the only one who piloted the ship or whatever, right?
So
you
have like in Aliens, right?
Yeah, Aliens, he became Lance Hendrickson, became the good guy. Yeah. I was going to say too, and I don't know, I have the system that the Twilight 2000 Free League version. I don't have the original, I've got a PDF of it somewhere, but you know, remember Kelly's Heroes? Yeah. So you have a mission in that where, you know, we've discovered that in Krakow, the Polish bank, you know, there's 5 million in gold that no one knows about or something, and you have a team of people. And again, I always looked at that game, everyone seemed pretty desperate to just get out. It wasn't quite that organized, right? Everybody was just sort of trying to survive. But in a system where you are in a modern type system, in a bang where it's broken down society or something or some area, that you could go in, get the gold, and come back out, and then you need help from people like the, you know, Panzer tank commander in Kelly's Heroes or whatever, where, look, if we all work together, we can
betray you at the end.
Yes, exactly. So that's always the question, because I always feel like if the players know that if you have some NPC that runs with them, some minion for months and months, and suddenly they stab them in the back, they're like, what? But if they know there's a chance they're a little shaky, they'll accept that because this guy, the Panzer guy, had a tank. And he blew open the doors of the vault. So I just don't know. I think that, and that's like a Western in World War II, right? Because you have these mercenaries, because none of these soldiers would actually, they're just operating on their own dime here in the middle of the war in Europe. That just wouldn't happen. You know, it's just sort of it's a fun movie, but it's pretty silly. But but the idea there is very much a Western idea where there is no law and order.
Yeah, I get that. And actually, I think the classic adventure, The Black Madonna, this kind of has that framing where some warlord wants you to go to this nuked city to go get it, but you probably have an inkling that this guy's going to betray you and take it anyway, right? So then it's up to the players to act first or wait till the warlord actually betrays you, right? So that's a cool, you could do that in any genre. It's kind of neat that you could do that and it doesn't have to be treasure. It could be like magic item, like KR mentioned. All right. So, you know, it's just kind of a fun adventure idea to do.
Yeah.
Myriad of genres.
Yeah. Westerns are so great to adapt. I do it all the time because they have this basic frontier wilderness wild thing. That's why the Europeans love Westerns. They, you know, they're all over the world, Japanese, because they are this idea of this untamed west, you know, the indigenous people, they're sort of there in the periphery. But again, you're going across and you're doing all this stuff. But again, in a modern game, you could also have, like they had, the Mexican revolutionaries. These are the people that are being, and the players confront them, and they need this gold to finance their revolution or whatever. And what do the players decide to do? You know, because, you know, and those are the kind of choices that players make and have to make. The henchmen are like, we're taking the money. You know, what do you mean? I don't care about these guys. But or not, are the henchmen secretly working for the revolution? I mean, you could just add layers of things as you go through this as the GM. So these kind of stories are just so great to adapt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I think for the players, you might give them like a secret or two, but then the big moral choices, you let them decide through the course of gameplay, I think.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Because it's you have to let the player, that's the tricky thing, because you have to be open to letting the players decide what they want to do and reap the consequences of what they decide. So if they decide that they're going to try to screw the Rebels, that's their choice, but they're going to have to accept the consequences, or maybe they'll decide to join the Rebels, who knows. But
so I think bottom line, and maybe I've matured since the Aces and Eights debacle back when you ran, Jason, but I think, because especially now, since I'm running like this Pathfinder adventure path called Bloodlords, where, do the players even trust each other? Because, everyone's eat or be eaten in that type of, context.
Right.
And Bloodlords is like a ruled by undead, people are cattle, basically. And if you're alive, are you going to be someone's next meal, or are you going to join the ranks of the undead and rule, right? And everyone has different factions and agendas. So, I think it's a fun, way to play, as long as you let the players know, that expectation ahead of time, I think.
Yeah, where the ball got dropped in the Aces Eights game is I didn't properly convey the idea that you weren't a team. I tried to convey that, but I dropped the ball.
I missed it. It could be me just missing it, right?
Yeah, because I think everybody else picked it up. But that's the people who shot you picked it up.
I think player versus player always works in a one shot or a three shot or something like that. I never think it can work in a campaign, but I just my experience, people, you got to cooperate, you got to get along. And I think people want to cooperate and get along. It's mm-hmm. our conflict
team game.
We're conflict adverse. I mean, we enjoy looking at it and watching it, but in our interpersonal, we want to work with people we can trust. But certainly in a one shot where you're, I played years ago in a Boot Hill thing where this guy had this whole town set up, and it was all based on movie stars. So you got to be the paladin, or you got to be Eli Wallach as Tuco, and he had certain abilities, and everybody had a secret. Everybody had a mission. They were going in this town, and you knew at the end, John Wayne was going to show up with the federal craft. And that was it. Cause John Wayne hits every time, critical hits. If you hit him in the head, it's a light wound. I mean, he was just unstoppable, right? He was just a device for the referee. But it was really fun because we were all against each other. If you saw other people, you got into gunfights and we're all maneuvering, trying to find this, whatever we had. And it worked great as a one shot, but of course, as a campaign, I just don't think it's going
to
work.
I think the one way you might be able to do this as a campaign is if you did, it would be tough, but if you did an old style, like play by post or something where the GM is interacting with the different people separately, you might be able, but again, it's more of a one shot thing. Mm-hmm. But I think what we talked about today, and like Carl and Carol brought up, the idea of using your hirelings and the NPCs, maybe not your hirelings, but the people that hired you that are going with you, the soldiers that are accompanying you as that other party you have to fight against, not fight against, but they're the PvP, right? So you're mm-hmm. you have to ally with them, but you don't know how long it's safe to ally with them. I mean, it's no different than Assault on Precinct 13 or anything where, we have to trust you enough. We need you to get to be alive, but I don't know if I can trust you with a gun. That whole kind of we see this so often in fiction. And I think that having to do that tense team up with somebody isn't your friend and just waiting to see who's going to turn the tables first.
Maybe that wasn't appealing to a lot of the critics or people who maybe had not been thrown into that situation where you have to make, allies of enemies, even temporarily, or cooperate with people you don't necessarily like, right? I mean, like, think of all the rivalry between the British and American forces in the, in World War II, but they definitely were their strongest allies, and we did cooperate with them despite,
We did lend lease to Russia, and there was certainly anti-Russian sentiment in the United States. I mean, a small group was pro-Russian, sort of left intellectual. Most people thought the Bolsheviks, they were not our, but we needed them to defeat Germany, right? And they made some movies about that, and a lot of those people that made those movies got in trouble after the war, as and even the premature fascists were the people that fought in the Spanish Civil War and stuff like that, because they were considered communists and stuff. So it's just interesting. The enemy of my enemy is my friend until the war's over.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Or until you get that gold.
Yes. Exactly.
Exactly. I think that's a good place to end this. So I want to thank both of you for coming on. Carl, is there anything you want to plug or tell people where to find you?
You can find me on the Geomologist Presents podcast. It's on many of your podcast catchers, Apple, Spotify, etc. And you can check out, I've just started it recently, like within the last 3 months, is a Geomologist Presents YouTube channel where we do actual play. And sometimes, well, my wife and I have been reviewing movies right now. So we did Casablanca for Valentine's Day. We've done some Westerns. So yeah, check that out. There's some actual play, a lot of very various games on that one, including Twilight 2000, Walking Dead. And we're starting to get into some old school type games too. So it's pretty, like I said, wide variety of games.
Excellent. KR, where can people find you?
Well, I have my YouTube channel, D&D Homebrew, where I talk about world building. I call it D&D because and from my era, and we called all RPG D&D. You want to play D&D? And everyone knew, oh, this is the game, though. It's, you know, Castles and Crusade, you know, but it's D&D. That's what you'd always say. So I do kind of world building and stuff. And then I have a podcast, Monsters and Treasure, that I do with Daniel Norton of Bandit's Keep each week. So you can check those out. Again, we talk about being a GM and all sorts of stuff on there about role-playing games.
Excellent. And there'll be links to all that in the show notes. So go check them out. Folks, thank you for tuning in. I want to thank my guests for joining me. I want to thank TJ for the wonderful music, Ray Otis for the coffee cup clip art, even though today we've got a poster of Eric Cruz up. And until next time, be excellent to each other.
Bye. Thank you.
Thanks.
Your auntie or a joke about your spouse, but the operator's screaming it's coming from inside the house. What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? What's in the box? Well, the audience is pretty sure he took a pretty head, and the only question left is if I could shoot him dead. Bring on the gore, bring on the gore. Here is a dice man and your moil is by the tipper, and I'm assuming that your partner back there in the wood chipper. Don't look away, don't look away, don't look away, don't look away. Well, the zombies are arising and the world has gone to heck. We're living for the dying and we're dying for the train wreck.